And we're now very excited to be joined on the School Bell by the very successful children's author, Debbie Galori. And it's a pleasure to have you on the School Bell.
A few days ago, Scotland's favourite children's authors were revealed at Scotland's Children's Book Awards, which you were nominated for, so we thought it would be the perfect opportunity to get an interview with you. First of all, have you always wanted to be a writer?
Actually, no, oddly. I wanted to be all sorts of things, starting off with when I was terribly small. I really seriously thought it was possible to be a princess. And then I realised that for a commoner like me, the only way to become a princess was to marry one of the available princes. I took one look at them and thought, do you know what? I think a different career is, up for grabs. So from then on, I think I wanted to be an artist, but my parents said, probably not the best of ideas. You never make any money. It's really, really hard to do something sensible. So something sensible involved an awful lot of science at school, which made me really, really totally and utterly miserable. And I vaguely entertained notions that it might be a nice idea, to be an astrophysicist. I don't know why I thought that was good, but I did think it was good. And then I left school and sort of life took hold of me, and I realised actually what I really, really wanted to be was an artist. So I went to art college, and the rest, it didn't follow in a straight progression, but it sort of followed after that.
So when you were growing up, were there any authors or artists who inspired you?
There were loads, but I suppose I didn't really realise at the time that they were inspiring me, but I was an only child, and I read an awful lot when I was little, just I suppose because I found it quite hard to make friends, so I sort of fell into books as not as a friend substitute, but just because that was what I did. And I suppose starting with sort of really well-known authors like Kenneth Graham, who wrote The Wind and the Willows, and E. Nesbitt, who wrote Five Children and It, and lots and lots of books sort of came my way. So they all in their turn really, I suppose, influenced me. And then I was given a copy of The Hobbit when I think I was about 11, and that was utterly magical, and I really, really loved that. And I can only really see now as an adult that that must have had quite a profound effect, because I've got this passionate love for dragons, and the only place that those could possibly have come from was from The Hobbit and from The Lord of the Rings, the book, not the film. I hasten to add, Benedict Cumberbatch's voice is so wrong, but never mind, that's only my humble opinion. So I mean, sort of books and authors were really, really sort of huge influences on me. In terms of artists, I came from a family where my dad was an art teacher when I was growing up, and I was sort of dragged around galleries as a child, and I loathed it, absolutely hated it. It was just utter hell on toast, and I always wanted to go home, and I don't really know if any of the pictures were seeping into my consciousness. And my appreciation for artists really only came once I went to art college and I began to see just how hard it was to paint pictures, and then my sort of awe at what they were doing grew. But I've always been, I suppose, more fond of illustrators than I have been of painters. So, I suppose all of the great illustrators, starting with Maurice Sendak and Helen Oxenbury and Quentin Blake and, the greats like that. But also the sort of modern ones who are sort of pushing the boundaries of illustration, people like Oliver Jeffers, are amazing. Sean Tan, I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but there are some amazing artists out there. So.
What would you say was your favourite subject while you were at school?
Well, it certainly wasn't maths, that's for sure. Sorry to all the maths teachers out there who are grinding their teeth. I loved art and I loved English. But again, my parents kept saying, you can never make a living doing those. So I was sort of shoehorned into doing physics and chemistry, which I most emphatically loathed. But I would sneak up to the art room at lunchtime. I didn't actually even take it as a subject at school. And I begged the art teacher to let me do my higher, even though I was already taking, too many other subjects. So she let me do that. And English was just a joy because that was just making up stories as far as I could see. And I mean, anyone with half a brain could see what this child is going to do is probably write books and draw pictures for a living. But no, my parents wanted me to be, sort of a scientist. I have no idea why. Anyway.
Do you get most of your inspiration from East Lothian or from your childhood in Glasgow?
I think emotional inspiration, the sort of the territory that makes a writer is probably, this sounds really incredibly posy, but I think what makes people write is difficulty. And I think in some ways, if you've had quite a tricky childhood, you can mine it endlessly as a writer. It will give you endless material, even if it will also give you a vast amount of psychiatric help bills in later life. But so the emotional territory of Glasgow and my childhood has been hugely helpful to me as a writer. But in terms of the pictures in my head, East Lothian has supplied endless amounts of them. I mean, everywhere I go in East Lothian, I take a camera, I take a sketchbook, and I also take my memory, because everywhere I turn is just full of things that I want to put in my books. And although my illustrations are not particularly realistic, I know when I look at each one where the ideas came from. It's not as if you could actually point to a page and go, gosh, that was Tinningham Woods, or look, that's Whittingham, or that's the beach, you know, at Dunbar. But I know that it is. So that, and also the west coast of Scotland, the sort of wilder bits have sort of played a big part in my books as well.
Which of your books are you most proud to have written?
Oh, that's so much like sort of saying, of all your children, which one is secretly your favourite? I could never do that with children, but I suppose books that... The two sort of kind of things that I'm most proud of are books that were absolutely a total pig to write, and that I've had to overcome. Sort of, you know, I've had to vanquish dragons in order to write the books, and sort of overcome sort of, you know, personal difficulty. So books like that, I am quite proud of. But really, the books that I'm most proud of are the ones that people write to me about and say, these have really, really helped me with, you know, certain phases in my life, or these have really made my child's, you know, sort of difficulties over simple things like going to bed, or over complex things like being bullied at school, or over really, really tragic things like, you know, when my child lost her father, your book really, really helped with that. So I think head and shoulders above everything I've ever done, a book called No Matter What. I'm still amazed that I wrote it, because I don't really feel like I wrote it. It was almost like it just happened. And I thought, my goodness, where did that come from? So I'm quite proud of that. I'm also quite proud of the book I wrote last year called Dragon Loves Penguin, because I wrote it partly as a request to a little boy who was adopted, and then the adoption failed. And that, for that little boy, that was just the most awful thing for him to happen, because, you know, all his natural family had fallen apart, his adopted family fell apart, and he was then just sort of kind of cast adrift. And he is, you know, in a good place now, but he said to me, write a book about me. And I said, I have no idea how to write a book about you. I really don't know how, but I'll do my best. But don't hold your breath, because, you know, these things take time. So in a funny sort of way, the book I wrote last year called Dragon Loves Penguin is about that little boy, and yet it's not. It's a book about adoption and about sort of belonging to a family that wasn't the one that you were born into. But from the response I've had from adoptive families and people who've been adopted, I've realised that actually that book has touched hearts. I'm kind of proud of that one too.
Yeah. So, referring to a book that you have written, which character would you say that you're most like?
Oh my goodness. I sort of vary from day to day. If I'm feeling utterly pathetic and sorry for myself, then I do actually feel like the penguin in Dragon Loves Penguin, who is the adopted poor little soul that is, you know, starts off as an egg abandoned in an ice floe. That's on my worst days. On the days where I feel vaguely capable and sort of on top of my game, I feel like the nanny character in the Pure Dead Magic series. This is not very flattering to me, though, I have to say, because I've always imagined her as actually beyond middle age, because she's a sort of almost immortal, so she must be about 3,000 years old. That tells you all you need to know about being middle aged. Her name is Flora McLachlan, and she bakes the best cakes in the Western universe, and I would like to think I can occasionally rise to do that, but not all the time. But I do love her because she is very unflappable, and I aspire to be like her. But secretly, I'd really quite like to be the mother in the Pure Dead Magic books, the most beautiful woman in the world, but that's just not going to happen, is it? So, anyway. So.
Right now, we're going to play Good Time by Owl City, but make sure you tune in after this to hear the second part of Debbie's interview. That was Good Time by Owl City on the North Berwick High School Bell with Catherine and Lindsay, and this is the second part of our interview with Debbie Gleary. So, Debbie, do you have any advice for budding young authors or illustrators who might be listening?
It's a really boring bit of advice, but it goes something like read and then read and read some more, and once you finish reading, keep on reading, and read out with your comfort zone. Read stuff that you wouldn't normally read. Borrow adult books. Actually, you probably already read adult books. What am I saying? Just keep going, and don't obsess about becoming a published writer. There's plenty of time for that, because actually once you become a published writer, one of the sort of problems with that is it almost stops you writing. I know that sounds really dumb, but actually the more successful you become, the less time you have to practice your craft. The great thing about being an unpublished writer is that nobody knows how good you are yet, so you have the time to actually develop your voice and to just work out a way of actually telling the stories that are in your heart and your head. But you will only get those stories, A, by reading, and B, by living. And if you're very young and if you're at school, in truth, you haven't lived quite enough yet. You need just a wee bit more time just to get out in the world and explore it and then write about it. But for heaven's sake, read.
Can you describe a typical day in your writing process?
I don't know if there's such a thing as a typical day, but I suppose if I average them all out, because some days I am actually away from my studio and I'm sort of, you know, sort of, I can be anywhere. I'm in the world, really, but mainly in Scotland, sort of talking in schools and libraries, but sometimes in schools and libraries on the other side of the globe. But if we factor those kind of days out, a typical day, brace yourself, starts at 5:30 in the morning, and I get up, the alarm goes off, and I get in my car and I go to the gym. And it's not, I don't go to the gym because it's particularly wonderful for the writing process, but in a funny sort of way it is, because when I'm there, I'm not actually thinking about books, despite the fact I carry a wee book with me while I'm there. And I think all the other clients at the gym think I'm thinking deep thoughts about my next novel. I'm not. I'm thinking deep thoughts about how on earth I can breathe for the next half hour as I sort of punish myself. But there's something about the afterburn of having worked out quite hard at that time in the morning that does help the writing process. So I come back home, get back home at 8, in time to wave goodbye to my daughter going to school. Then I have breakfast, and then I go into my little shed in the garden at about 9, and I usually start the day by answering emails and just sort of dealing with boring stuff like admin. And at the moment, my favourite kind of days are the days that actually I'm drawing pictures, because that's so much easier than writing, I can't tell you. But if it was a writing day, what I would do would be to start by editing what I'd written the day before, because it's really, really hard to actually start the day by just sort of going straight into writing. I almost have to sneak up on the writing without it knowing that I'm doing it, and then pounce before it knows I'm there. And there's sort of various ways of doing that. So writing anything but the work in hand is usually the best way to do that. So that's what I'll do. So I'll edit what I do the day before. And I am such a creature of habit that if I don't have coffee at 11 o'clock, you know, the world comes to a screaming standstill. And if I don't have lunch at 1, ditto. And if I don't have afternoon coffee at 3:30, you know, I can't function. But there's a sweet spot in the day, because all of this is faffing around when I'm writing. This is why writing's so difficult, because I'll write and rub out and write and rub out and score it, because I write by hand. And edit onto my computer, but when I'm writing the first draft, I write with a fountain pen and a notebook. And I make such a mess until about 4:15 in the afternoon. This is crazy. The whole day is spent doing stuff that goes in the bin. And then something happens at 4:15 in the afternoon. It's quite magical. And finally, it starts to flow. And then I can't stop. And then I'm writing. But unfortunately, well, not unfortunately, wonderfully, I have a family requiring fed who start sort of clawing piteously at the windows at 5:30 if I'm not actually sort of making sort of movements towards the house to go and start doing things to sausages. So I have a very, very short but very productive period in a day. So.
Before we come to our final question, we heard that you're taking part in a very exciting event next week. So would you like to tell us a bit more about that?
It's sort of very exciting and utterly and absolutely terrifying. It's called an Illustration Slam, and it's taking place in the Glasgow BBC television studios over in Victoria Quay next week on Thursday at 11 o'clock. And I think anybody in the world can watch it. In fact, that's the general idea of it, that it will be beamed out to the whole Commonwealth. And you can get the link to watch it through Scottish Book Trust. And if you go onto Scottish Book Trust's website and then go onto Illustration Slam, anyone can watch this. And it's basically three illustrators, myself as one of them, Chris Riddell, who's the political cartoonist for The Guardian, and Pete Grobler, who is an amazing South African illustrator. Three of us illustrating live on TV.
First we're going to have the news and then we'll hear more from Debbie. Thank you. We are joined by Debbie Gleary, the top Scottish children's author, and we are just coming to the end of our interview now, but before the news you were telling us about an event that you're taking part in next week. So
the Illustration Slam, Thursday, that's next week. Anybody can watch it. Go on to the Scottish Book Trust website next week and there will be a link to the Illustration Slam. It's three illustrators, myself included, drawing live to the nation, God help us, for 20 minutes, and it's a race to see who can finish their picture fastest, which just sounds like an absolute nightmare because I'm actually quite slow at first. Anyway, I'm kind of looking forward to it about as much as you look forward to a visit to the periodontist, but I am actually also quite looking forward to it because it's something I've never done before. And the idea of actually being watched by that many thousands of people right across the world is quite a heady thought. It's terrifying as well. So I have no idea how that will go, but nothing ventured, nothing gained.
Well, make sure you watch that. I'm sure that'll be very interesting. How do you like to set the mood when you're writing? Do you listen to any songs or...?
Yeah, I get my computer to do the music choosing for me, so it goes into shuffle mode and it will hurl up all sorts of strange things, you know, absolutely anything from Shetland fiddle music, which I feel obliged to grab my fiddle and join in with, which makes for a rather, I didn't add that into my typical working day, did I? But I do. If anyone was to watch through the windows of my studio, they would think I was quite insane as I leapt to my feet and grabbed the fiddle, but that's got to be infinitely better as far as my children are concerned, rather than me leaping to my feet and doing mum dancing, because, you know, it might even be David Bowie or Madonna or somebody else on the shuffle. So it really depends just what comes up. But I do like music in the background, but not when I'm writing. When I'm writing, I want absolute silence.
We're playing a David Bowie song next, which is the Jean Genie. Would you like to dedicate this song to anyone?
Oh, to my children, who would just die if they could see me dance to it.
Here's David Bowie. Debbie, thank you very much for the interview, and we hope you enjoy the event next week.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.